LA Times Studios and The Real. I'm Mark Olson, and I'm joined today by Christine McKenna, co-author with David Lynch of the new book, Room to Dream. Christine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And now you have a pretty long relationship with David Lynch. You first interviewed him for Wet magazine in 1979. What is it that draws you back to him? Over all this time, what do you sort of still find interesting about his work?
Well, for starters, David himself is a really extraordinary person. He's one of the reasons people continue to work with him for decades is because he's really a lot of fun. And I'm repeatedly drawn back to his work because it continues to be so interesting. I mean, he did things in Twin Peaks, The Return, the third season. He still can surprise me. And yeah, I have total respect for him.
And now, especially now that you're on the other end of this book project, do you feel like you have some new understanding of him, either as a person or as an artist? And in some ways, do you feel like you now have him figured out?
That's a huge question. You know, I have to say, a couple of the reviews have faulted me for not, quote unquote, explaining David, as if that's even possible or desirable. I can't even explain myself. So having spent all those years really immersing myself in he and his life, yes, I do feel like I have a better understanding of him. But I don't think I could boil it down to one or two sentences, and I wouldn't want to.
And now one thing I found fascinating in reading the book is you were actually on set for the making of Blue Velvet.
I was.
And that now just seems like a landmark film, both for David and even just sort of in the history of American cinema. Did it feel that way at the time? Like, what was it like to be there for the creation of a movie like that?
The way I ended up there is I met David and interviewed him and was very impressed. And then I found out he was shooting this film. I was writing for the LA Times then, and my editor was Irv Latofsky, and I pestered him until he agreed to let me go do a location piece. So I was there for about a week. The Times flew me there first class. Can you believe it? Anyhow, it was really fun. I didn't have the sense that I was there at the making of a turning point in cinema, which it turned out to be kind of, but it was a very magical set because it was a really long shoot. They were there for 9 months and they became like a family. It was just really fun being there.
In particular, Dennis Hopper's performance in that movie is something that I just find so riveting. I don't know what his working process was like. Essentially, I'm asking, was he scary to be around in the making of the movie, or is he the kind of actor that could sort of turn it on and turn it off?
No, he was scary. Dennis was scary. He was just coming off a really long, bad period, and he was kind of on probation at that point. This was one of the first jobs he got after really being out of the game because of drugs. So he was on his best behavior, but he was a very intimidating person. And I think he was hard on women. I think the fact that I was a female journalist didn't really work in my favor. He was very polite, and he was very smart, but he was scary.
You've stayed in touch with David sort of all through the years. You've written about him kind of on and off, but how did that build to the doing a book with him?
Well, David had mentioned on several occasions when I would see him over the years about all the bullshit that there was out about him in the press. And I wanted to do a book project, and I knew he wasn't happy with any of the books on him. So I said to him, let's do a book together. You can correct some of the misinformation out there about you, and you can make some money on your life story as opposed to everyone else doing that. And he said yes. He's very agreeable, really. And yeah, he said yes, and we laid down the ground rules of how we'd do the book, and that was it.
And how did the idea for the structure come about? Because it's unusual the way that it's done, in that it's part sort of conventional biography, part memoir. Where did that idea come from?
I came up with that idea, and the reason for that was I wanted David's voice to be really prominent in the book. I felt like if I interviewed him a lot and just intercut his commentary with all the other people I was interviewing, it wouldn't be as prominent. And also, David's personality, when he talks, he has a very unfettered imagination, and he goes off on funny tangents that are fascinating and usually funny. And I knew the book wouldn't be able to accommodate that if it was done in the conventional way. So to just let him talk in between, it just seemed like a good way to get his voice in there.
how did it kind of practically work? Were you providing him chapter by chapter, or what was the process of doing it?
I would do a chapter and send it to him, and he would read it, and then he would respond.
And those are kind of recordings of him? Like, are they just transcriptions of him talking?
No, I recorded our conversations, but then we worked on the transcripts together. He would elaborate on some things. There were many things he cut that he didn't want in there. So, yeah, and there were certain things I'd say, we need a little more about this. Can you say something about that? Often he'd say, no, I have nothing to say about that.
And just again, what for you is added by doing it in this way? Like, it's unlike any other book that I can think of. And for you, is it just the idea of getting more of David in the book? Or what do you think for a reader they're getting out of this they wouldn't from a more conventional book?
I think they're getting a better sense of his personality. He's more present in the book. And he just goes places in those chapters that if I had just come to him with a set of interview questions, we never would have gotten to. So, yeah, I think it just gave him a bigger canvas to be himself.
And were you ever surprised by what he did or did not respond to? I mean, especially in the earlier chapters about his childhood, his memories seem extremely present. Those things really seem to be just flowing out of him.
Yeah, he still has an extraordinary connection with his childhood, more so than most people I know, certainly more than me. He remembers it all really clearly, and he cherishes those memories. It was surprising to me the things he had. I mean, often there'd be an entire film. No, I have nothing to say about that. But then he'd go on at great length about, you know, a slice of pie or something. So David he's pretty unpredictable.
Tell me about some of the things that maybe you had to push him on or to get more out of him. In particular, his relationship with Isabella Rossellini, your interviews with her in your chapters, she's very candid about their relationship and especially the end of their relationship. And then in sort of David's responding chapter, he doesn't refer to it at all.
His options were to defend himself against Isabella's recounting of their breakup. He didn't want to do that. That is how they broke up. I don't think he felt really proud and happy of it. David doesn't like to hurt people. So I probably would have done the same thing if I was him. What is there to say except it ended and it wasn't good for her?
The biographical sections are quite frank about his personal life, his relationships, his affairs, his breakups. What was it like for you in kind of reporting those sections, like those deep personal details, and then having to see how he would respond? Were you always curious to see who he would mention or what he would or wouldn't talk about?
Well, some of the relationships, it took some work to get the women to be comfortable talking about it. But I knew I couldn't leave that out because that's a big part of his personality. You know, he's a person who wants to be perpetually in love, or he did. I don't know how he feels about it now. I think he's content now. But I wasn't surprised he didn't want to talk about that stuff because David's not an analytical person. I don't think he looked back on relationships and puzzled it out in his head what they meant and why things happened the way they did. They just happened and life went forward. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't want to talk about the breakups.
But then also, given the importance of sexuality and sort of male-female relationships in his work, do you feel like even though the book is not interested in sort of explaining David's work or getting into the idea of what these things mean, do you see some connection there? Like, is the way in which he deals with those issues in his work related in some way to his kind of checkered personal life?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I'd call it checkered. David he's a person who courts enchantment. He wants to be enchanted. And that's kind of a leitmotif in his work. Romantic love is always completely over the top. And that is a reflection of who he is.
Was it difficult for you, as someone who's been following his work for a long time, to not want to dig deeper into the meaning of the work?
Definitely not. You can't explain his work. Part of what's so beautiful about his work is it's so wide open and multi-layered that you can bring a million different meanings to it. And the work of his that's most powerful for me is the work that's most difficult for me to understand. So David would never explain a movie to anyone, and nor would I want him to. He has his own feelings about what a movie means, but he absolutely understands that everybody else is going to have a different meaning because we all come to watch it with a different perceptual apparatus.
And even just in his responses, like which films seemed more pleasurable for him to have made or to kind of reflect on, were there any surprises for you there? Like which movies he sort of like liked or didn't like or wanted to talk about more or less?
No, because we kind of all knew that Dune was a big bummer for him and that The Elephant Man was a trial by fire for him and that Fire Walk With Me was a beloved child that the world was cruel to. So no, I kind of knew. But he treasures all those experiences. You know, he had a hard time on The Elephant Man. And with Dune, he said, it was good for me to have a colossal failure.
One thing that really jumps out to me in the book is what an L.A. artist he is. The fact that he came here fairly early in his career, the chapters about the making of Eraserhead, I found all those stories like really interesting. And there was something kind of really inspiring about them. And just his relationship to the city and to here was something I guess I'd never quite considered before. And especially for you as someone who's been writing about art in Los Angeles for quite a while, was that something that you were kind of excited to draw out?
Well, David loves Los Angeles, and he loves the lore and the myth and the Hollywood myth of Los Angeles. He really loves all that. But he's not a regional artist. Regardless of where he lived, he would have been making the same paintings, I think, because his sensibility is not really shaped by what's around him. It's shaped from what's deep inside him. So, yeah, he's not a regional artist, but he loves Los Angeles. There aren't other artists making work like David in Los Angeles.
Well, I have to say, I was so surprised by the kind of celebrity cameos throughout the book. I mean, he, like, has friendship with Ringo Starr. He mentions Bob Dylan, Lunch with Elizabeth Taylor, this odd encounter with Marlon Brando. Like, those, I was not expecting any of that.
That surprised me, too. The Marlon Brando stories are kind of two of my favorite parts of the book. I mean, he visited Fellini a week before he died. He's a very modest person. You know, he's very humble. But, yeah, he's met everybody.
And now, in particular, like, say, the Brando stories, is that exactly the kind of thing that you feel like you wouldn't have walked in there wanting to ask him about a relationship with Marlon Brando that nobody knew about?
Well, I didn't know about it. That story would not have been in there if I hadn't structured the book as I did, because there would have been no place for it. I wouldn't have gotten to it anyway. It's like, you know, who dropped by your house in 1996? So, yeah. But I was surprised, too, that the Marlon Brando story, Elizabeth Taylor.
And now tell me a little bit more about kind of just the timeline of the book, like when it came about. And I'm asking this sort of specifically in relation to Twin Peaks, The Return. I'm wondering, like, what if you were sort of already working on the book when David sort of turned to that project, or if that came about while you were working on the book?
Oddly enough, I came up with the idea of the book and proposed it to him. I wasn't even aware that there was all this negotiating going on with Twin Peaks Season 3. And he agreed to do the book about a week before he finally settled things with Showtime and went forward with that project. So that was both good and bad. People were interested in him at that point, but he left for 2 years to make that. So it was hard working around that, but it was great, too.
Did him returning to Twin Peaks surprise you? Because I think is not an artist who seems to, like, as much as there are thematic things that run throughout his work, the idea of David Lynch making a sequel seems a little odd. And so what do you think it was that sort of drew him back to Twin Peaks and why he sort of returned to that project?
Well, David never left Twin Peaks. That's why when the second season of Twin Peaks ended and then he made Fire Walk With Me, he said, I wasn't ready to leave that place yet. I love the Palmer family. I wanted to be back there. And Twin Peaks is a structure that accommodates all kinds of aspects of his sensibility. So he never left there. He never left those characters.
If I may be so bold as to give a little bit of my interpretation of the show, I found this most recent season builds to being a real reconciliation of your past and your present. And so I think for David as an artist with where he is now, the idea of being in that place and doing that, of trying to come to grips with what this all means and what it might mean for some sort of future, I just found really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, he really does a lot in those 18 episodes, particularly episode 8 was some kind of huge summation of everything for me. I wouldn't really want to try to explain how, but it was very vast.
And David's practice with transcendental meditation is something that comes up all throughout the book. And what do you think the influence of that is on his work?
Wow, that's a good question. A lot of people say, oh, how can he be so spiritual and make these violent movies? I think David's spiritual beliefs give him a way of reconciling the dark and the light. And his beliefs are essentially Hindu beliefs. And he believes in karma. He believes in perfect justice, that nobody gets away with anything, even though in some of his films it seems like they do. Like, for instance, the Patricia Arquette character in Lost Highway. But I think it's given him, it gives him a way of being at peace with the darkness in the world, because he thinks it all works out somewhere in the end.
But that's a darkness that you think he does express in his work?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of darkness in his work. But he doesn't attach positive and negative to that. Like, the dark stuff is negative, the light stuff is good. It's all part of this huge ball of experience we're in, and you can't take any of it away. It's all necessary.
And now, as we're having this conversation, it's a week when David has been in sort of national headlines.
Yes.
Because of a quote that he gave in an interview with The Guardian about the president that was then taken somewhat out of context, and the president himself began to sort of like tout that he was a favorite of filmmaker David Lynch, which actually David then has sort of subsequently clarified his comments. And I think a lot of people can't help but note that a rare moment where David Lynch explained himself and made clear what he was really saying. Do you think of David in any way as a political artist?
I think of David as a philosophical artist, but not a political artist. And he doesn't really follow politics. And that was kind of an innocent comment. It was a valid comment. The fact that Trump has broken open the machine and maybe we can rebuild it in a better way now. And it was taken out of context and very unfortunate. But no, he's not a political person. He's a spiritual person. And that's on a whole other wavelength.
Especially in the later sections of the book, you really grapple with the way in which he's working across different media. Like, he's always very busy and he's doing a lot. He's making films, he's making art, he's involved in music. And what, especially for you in relationship to your own work, what does that mean? Like, I'm interested in the idea of you being interested in him kind of for his artistic practice as much as he is like a Hollywood filmmaker.
I went to art school. That's kind of my background, is in art. And he's not really taken seriously as a painter. It was kind of a curse of, you know, you can't. Now in art, there's a lot of people that work across media. There's a lot of visual artists who use film in their work. But when David started, that wasn't the case. And once he made a film, it's like he was kicked out of the art world. But he doesn't make those divisions. It's all, you know, he has a wood shop. Building a table is the same thing for him as making a film or making a record. It's all connected.
But do you think, even from Eraserhead forward, that it's a useful way to think of David, or to think of him within the context of fine art and this being more of like an artistic practice than as like a guy making movies?
Definitely. You can't really separate it out. As I say in the book, when he was on his sets, he's still making art. Right now, he's focusing on painting, but he still is thinking about films. So you can't separate it out.
And then in kind of relationship to your own work, especially the last few years, you've been working as a curator and doing work kind of more in the art world. I'm interested, is that the same for you as your journalism, in that it sort of is like connecting an audience with artists? Or what for you is kind of the impulse behind your own work?
Well, the reason I started curating and moved towards books is because it became really hard to make a living as a journalist. I just knew I had to reinvent myself somehow, and that was a way to do it. And doing books, one of the things that's bad about journalism is it's so impermanent, and books have a little more permanence. As for David and his art, you know, he's had retrospective shows all over the world except in America. It's really strange. His home city, this is where he's not taken seriously as a visual artist. I don't really understand why that is.
I've been so interested in some of the more recent work you've done, and particularly regarding the artist Wallace Berman. And you seem to have been really involved in sort of shining a spotlight on LA-based artists who are not very well known, in particular like some of the work you did about the artists who are just exhibited at the Ferris Gallery. And what has that kind of meant for you to be sort of bringing to light these sort of LA artists and a side of LA culture that people maybe didn't already know?
Well, it's a Wallace Berman. That was just a passion. I kind of just fell in love with him. He was so anti-commercial, and it was gratifying to learn that there had been this whole other art culture in Los Angeles that I hadn't known about that was kind of rooted in the hippie world, and it was much more generous. It wasn't about money and competition. I found it really moving.
I acknowledge the way in which this is kind of a self-serving question, but your book, Book of Changes, that was a collection of interviews that you did, like it feels curated and it feels like it sort of presents like a worldview in a way that I found really interesting. And do you feel like you were aware of that as you were working as a journalist with like the specific people you were talking to, Nina Simone, Captain Beefheart, Jenna Rollins, that they do all kind of like, you can put them together in a way. And like, do you think you were aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was championing people who I thought were amazing that were being neglected. Those are the people I would fight with my editors to let me write about. And yeah, the way I edited those books, definitely, there's a worldview. I feel like there's kind of some kind of moral compass in that book. I miss doing that.
But can you tease that out a little more? What for you is the connection there? This, I mean, all those people have, there's something of like the outsider about them. There's something about the outlaw about many of them.
Without sounding too high flown, there's a purity. All those, everybody in Book of Changes, I consider really profound artists. Most of them invented something new. They never turned their back on their muse. They never sold out. The thing that was driving them through life wasn't money. And that's kind of the through line in the book, I would say.
And do you feel like you still see parallel people to that now? Or do you think that kind of artist is something that we maybe don't have?
You know, that's a really tough question because when I look at popular culture now, I feel like, God, who are these people? I don't feel connected to it the way I used to. And I don't know if that's a function of age or just all the good people are dead now. I'm sure there are great artists out there, but, you know, growing up and then suddenly being in my 20s and being a journalist and knowing, wow, I could have a conversation with Ray Charles. That's unbelievable. I couldn't reproduce that experience now.
To get back to David, do you have a favorite one of his movies?
I love them all. It would probably be between Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive.
And why is that? Mulholland Drive in particular, what is it that you like about that one?
Mulholland Drive is so dreamy and vast, and it's basically about a broken dream. And so it's very moving. Emotionally, it's very moving to me.
That movie in particular, I found your chapter on it so insightful. I mean, that movie is famously was a failed pilot. David sort of reworked the material, shot some new material, and then it became the movie that we know. And I feel like I've never read anything that sort of unraveled so well what the difference was, like what was from the pilot and what was the kind of new material. And was that something you were sort of excited to tease out?
I loved working on that chapter because it's such a rich story and it's David refusing to compromise. It's a classic example of that. He just stood his ground and then he got what he wanted in the end. So it was interesting to me to find out that the relationship between the two women didn't come until those 18 pages that he added after the fact.
But also the second character, Naomi Watts' sort of like alter ego
right.
character, was something that was new.
Yeah, Diane. So obviously the whole thing got incredibly richer with the addition of the 18 pages.
And I have spoken to David a couple of times, but always on the phone. I've never actually interviewed him in person. And so the last thing I want to ask you, and please pardon the question, how magnificent is his hair?
His hair is pretty magnificent. I interviewed him about a week ago on stage, and there was an audience question, how do you get your hair to stand up the way you do? And he says, I have a stern talk with it every morning.
And with that, we will wrap it up. Christine McKenna, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
For LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson.